Oh, by the way, one other thing. We might put the first one back up, Tracy. Yeah. Now, also those churches, the churches these letters are written to, are all on the map there on the right. Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia. Laodicea. I believe they're all up there on the map. So I'm not going to take the time to look at one each time, except notice that Ephesus is located farther to the south. Almost due north is Smyrna. Almost due north of that is Pergamum. And then you come over to Thyatira and Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea. And so just kind of fix in your mind where those places are as we talk about the letters to the seven churches. Okay, thank you. All right, now as we prepare to move into chapter 2, I want to tell you once again that when we look at the parts of the book of Revelation, we have to believe that the Holy Spirit had a distinct purpose, even in the order of things that He dealt with. And so as He's going to be dealing with things in 4 and 5 and 6 and the rest of the book, He is going to be showing us the throne and the power, the awesome power and majesty of God in chapter 4. And then He's going to tell us in chapter 5 of a scroll in the right hand of Him that sat upon the throne, a scroll that just had to be opened. Be the greatest tragedy one could possibly imagine if that scroll was not open, and yet there was no one in heaven or on earth to open the scroll. And so John says he wept much because there was no one to open it. And then one of the elders told him, "Don't weep. One has been found, the Lamb that is of the tribe of Judah," and so on. "He has overcome." And so it wasn't before that there wasn't anyone that had the power to open the scroll. It was that there was no one who had done what had to be done before the scroll could be opened. And Jesus was the only one to do that. So when He had done what had to be done, He overcame. And having overcome, He was then in the position to take the scroll and open it. And as He opens the scroll, we see an unfolding, a revealing of things that happen, forces that are upon this earth that every person on earth has to deal with. And the Christian has to deal with those forces also. And the Christian has to deal with some forces that other people don't have to deal with. So as the unfolding of the Messiah's work, the unfolding of God's plan continues, there are consequences that follow from it. And as these consequences follow from it, we find a struggle going on between the saints and the world and the forces in the world, and the saints are having to struggle to overcome these things and so on. And then we are shown from chapter 12 on more of an emphasis on the spiritual battle that is going on in heavenly places, which is why this struggle on earth is going on between good and evil. The struggle on earth between good and evil is reflected or is mirrored in a deeper spiritual struggle between God, and particularly Jesus the Messiah, and His archenemy, the devil. So as these things are going on, the saint is being told that God is going to win the victory through Jesus, and that we, if we're on His side, we will win the victory as well. But before we are ready to talk about the saint, as the saint is dealing with the forces of the world out here, and with the forces of the devil, before we're ready to take on the devil and all of that, I believe that the point of these seven letters, the reason why they're here, right at the front, is because before we saints get out here dealing with the things out here in the world that we face, in the world and in our lives, we need to get our own affairs in order. If we're going to be overcoming, then we need to be sure we are in a position to overcome. And we cannot assume that overcoming will just automatically happen. And you will note that in the letters, over and over again, that idea of overcoming is mentioned. So that one of the great themes, in fact, just pretty well the theme of the book of Revelation, is overcoming. Overcoming. The Messiah overcoming the devil and his agents. Our overcoming the temptations and the trials of life and the forces that beset us, overcoming. But before we can overcome, we need to make sure that we have our affairs in the church in order. And so I believe that this is why here he begins with these letters to the seven churches. And the vision that is in chapter 1 shows Jesus standing in the middle amongst the lampstands, which are specifically said to represent the churches. And he threatens more than once to talk about removing the lampstand, so that you can picture him as he's standing there among the lampstands. And he is displeased with the church because of something about that church. And he removes the lampstand, meaning that he no longer recognizes that church as his. He no longer recognizes that church and those people as a part of his reign, of his kingdom. And he rejects them. That lampstand is removed. So he is the one who literally possesses all authority in heaven and on earth. Just like he said in the Great Commission in Matthew 28. All authority hath been given unto me in heaven and on earth. So he has the power. He has the power to tell the churches what they need to do. And the churches must respond to him, respecting his authority and doing what he says. You know, as you think about that idea, and you think about the situation that prevails today among denominations, many churches throughout the world, the last thing on earth on their mind is the idea of respecting the wishes of Jesus. I mean, you just think about churches that we read about in the newspaper and the stuff that they're doing and the things they want to do and the things that are important to them. Are they even saying, "Hey, Lord, what do you want us to do?" Is their ear open? They have ears to hear. Are they hearing? No, they're not even asking. So we need to be really aware of the point that is made here in this vision. And another thing in that vision of Jesus in chapter 1, you're not seeing, for example, remember when Pilate had Jesus scourged and Jesus had been beaten and mistreated so much, and he brought him out and he said, "Behold the man." Wonder how he would have looked. Pretty pathetic. Pretty pathetic. Bloody and beaten. Now, this Jesus we see in this vision here is not pathetic. He is not pathetic. He is not bloody. And he is not beaten. The one here is obviously deity in all his power, with those glowing eyes and the feet that are like burnished brass. Here is the one who is full of all majesty. This is the King. And he won't ever be that humble Nazarene anymore. That was in his life on earth when he came here to serve. He is now King and he rules at the right hand of God. And so this is the picture of him that we see here. And this is the one who is able to say, and it must be done. So in these letters now that he's going to dictate, these are letters to the seven churches. These seven churches, as you saw on the map, were real churches. They were real churches. He did not make up churches. He did not make up things that were wrong at those churches. But he could have written letters to the 14 churches. He could have written letters to the 35 churches or to the 110 churches. But he wrote letters to the seven churches. I believe probably choosing the number of seven to help us to understand that though these are real churches and real problems at those churches, he was also presenting before us a spectrum of the conditions that would exist at churches, not only in that day, but throughout the ages. Here is a selection of problems and everything that would exist at churches that would tend to compromise their identity. And those things must be given attention to. And so, like I say, he could have chosen other churches to dictate letters to. For example, if he had wanted to write a church and tell them that if they didn't straighten up, he was going to remove their candlestick, wouldn't Corinth have been a good one? But see, he didn't even mention Corinth here. Corinth is not here at all. John, in his later years, according to the information we have from the historians, church fathers, and what have you of that day, indicate that John did a lot of his work, lived and died in that area of Asia. So since he worked there in Asia, that may be why the Spirit chose the churches there in Asia for John to dictate those letters to. They would have known John, and John would have known them. And so that's probably why the Spirit selected them rather than churches somewhere else. So as these letters begin, there are a few things in the symbol there of him and the seven stars in his right hand, the seven golden candlesticks, like in verse 20. The mystery of the seven stars which you saw in my right hand and the seven golden candlesticks. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven candlesticks are seven churches. Okay, so I don't need to wonder about what the candlesticks or the lampstands are. They're churches. Now, I've told you everything I know about that. The angels, the seven stars that he holds, are the angels of the seven churches. Now, about that, even though there didn't seem to be any question about the people of that day understanding what John meant by that, there is a question about what we are to understand by that. And I have never read an explanation that just blew me away and said, oh, that's it right there. So all I can do is suggest some various ideas. And Buford, I suppose you and Jerry did that. Some of the ideas, one of them is that it's talking about the fact that each church has its celestial angel in heaven looking after it. Well, if that's true, I'd sure hate to prove it. Suggestion? Yeah. But I couldn't prove that. I find so little evidence about that. Maybe so, but that doesn't seem to appeal to me. Another one is that the angel, and this one is an interesting explanation, this one is the angel of the church in each case is the chief elder. Point about that is that we don't have any evidence whatever, certainly not in the Bible. There is not one jot of evidence in the Bible that there was any practice of having one elder chief over the others. And even in church history, we don't see that coming to pass until the middle of the second century, by about 150 A.D. By about 150 A.D., we begin to see the development of the bishopric, where one of the presbyters was lifted above the others, and he was called the bishop. That's happening by 150, but there's no evidence whatever it's happening back here. Since the word angel itself simply means a messenger, some think that it is talking about the messenger who came to John to tell him about things over there in Asia and somebody's going to carry this back. Somebody's going to have to carry this. So maybe it's the messenger. But the letter that is written in a personal way as to involve the angel himself and whatever is going on there. So some say it is the collective eldership. It is the eldership, those who lead and guide and teach the flock. Well, that makes better sense to me than some. But I don't know for sure which is the explanation. So I just have to tell you that. So you are free to study and try to decide for yourself. But I'll just tell you, I cannot nail that down for you. I have no evidence that enables me to nail that down. So here are some suggestions. One other suggestion, which is favored by some good students of the book of Revelation, is that the angel of the church here refers to the inner spirit and character of each of these churches. And that may be. The only problem I have with that explanation is relating it to choosing the word angel or messenger. I don't really see a strong connection there. So those are the various possibilities, and there probably are more, but I think those would be the ones worthy of consideration. So you can think about it, and if one of them comes to your mind is better than others, that's fine. But don't go eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Always try to have some reason for making your decision. And if you cannot make the decision, it is better not to make the decision. That's what I've chosen to do. Now, anyone like to make a point about that? I'd be glad to have you make a point about it. Anyone?
How what?
Yes. 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 And it could be, you know, that would be the idea of the messenger, or even carrying back for the one that's going to read it to the group. So, yes, that could be. Now, we know that earlier I mentioned to you, blessed is the one that, verse 3 of chapter 1, blessed is he that reads and they that hear. And remember, I made the point at the time that he's not saying in verse 3 of chapter 1 that whether you read it or whether you hear it. Not, you know, here's the same individual. Here's the same individual. Now, whether you read it or whether you hear it, that's not what he's saying there. He's talking to two different parties. He's talking to the one who reads and the one who hears, not or the one who hears. So I believe that there's evidence there of the idea, Mike, that it was a typical thing, very typical, for someone to read it to the group. Reading, the ability to read was, I think, fairly widely possessed, especially among Jews. They would receive the training to read, at least in the language of the Scripture, so they could read the Scriptures for themselves. And some of them could write, but I'd say generally over the Roman world as a whole, that reading and writing was not something you could take for granted. I'd say that I don't have any figures on that. But I would say that it was not just universal, almost universal, as it is now. Okay. Yes. Yes, yes. I really believe. See, Buford, if these books did not fit in this whole book of Revelation, then a whole bunch of the power and the message here would be missing. Therefore, I believe that each one of those churches would have received a copy of the book of Revelation, because it's not just the seven letters. The seven letters are merely the very important and powerful prologue to the message that is to come, and they serve such an interlocking function, I just don't see how they could very well have been separated. Yeah. 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 And just like you and I are reading the letters to all of the seven churches, I think they had that. I think they did that too, so that each of the churches, each of the seven churches that received it, could read the comments of the Lord about the other. And then, of course, as it spread beyond that, churches all over the Mediterranean world would have been able to do that. And the point was not that we should pick on these seven, but that we should look at these seven and what the Lord was saying to them, and then profit from that message. But yes, I do believe that the whole thing, it was a unit. I have never heard or seen any evidence that it was broken up. Usually, if a book was ever broken up, the way we know for sure it was broken up was either from internal statements to that effect, or we find manuscripts of it broken up. And we never find any manuscripts of it broken up, you know, like that. So I believe that definitely it was a united thing. Those seven letters went with the whole book. So whatever the angel is, they knew. There was no question about that. Yes, Mike? For what? Angel? Okay, it was an angelos. Angelos. And it just means a messenger. Yes. And the word could be used of a human messenger. That would be the word you would use for a human messenger as well. Angelos. Yes. To the angel. Yeah. See, he's telling John, to the angel of the church, write. So, see, John is being told to write to the angel of this church. The reason why we're having that problem, Mike, is because our translation renders that angel. And actually, in other words, when a Greek saw that word, angelos, when a Greek saw the word angelos, he saw the word messenger. That's, you know, that's just what it meant. And so our translators have gone ahead and rendered it angel, maybe because they weren't sure what it meant. So just like they rendered baptize or baptizo baptize rather than translate it. But the word angelos just means a messenger. In fact, the word to preach the message, to preach the gospel, is euangelizomai. The angelizomai is a part of the idea of the angelos. See, spread the message, the good message. Take the good message around. So basically the word means a messenger. But beyond that, I really don't know. But whoever it was, whatever it was a way of communicating the will of the Lord to the angel of the church in Ephesus, right? So we can see that this had to be something that would be able to communicate what is being written to this church. The church was supposed to learn about this. The church was supposed to know about this. These things saith he. We start out with a self-designation. Jesus says, this is who I am. These things saith he that holdeth the seven stars in his right hand, he that walketh in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. So, remember that the seven stars are designated as the angels of the seven churches. And so, I am the one that holds the seven stars in my right hand. This is the one who walks in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. So, as you go along, just sort of bear in mind how he identifies himself. Identifies himself in different ways. Most of the time, at least, it goes back to the vision that you see of him there in chapter 1. Most of the time, he's going to go back to that vision that John has seen, and in order that he may identify himself. Now, as he talks to the church here in Ephesus, he says, I know your works. Now, we can just stop there and think about that. We're not going to camp out on it very long, but just stop there for a moment. Here is Jesus among the churches. He says, I know your works. What does that make you think? Yes. 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 That's right. Yes. That's right. That's right. I know thy works. Say that again. He's familiar with them. And I want to know something else. Yes, Mike? All right. When you read that, I know your works. The thing I'm so aware of is that, yes, Jesus knows. He knows your works and he knows my works. He knows Ephesus' works. He knows Eastside's works. The thing that each church and each individual has to know is that this is the one who has the power to know. He understands. He is aware. He knows. Whatever we do, we're not hiding it from him. And that's one reason why I sometimes marvel at people who decide to embark on some terribly immoral course of life. And at first they hide it from mom and dad, and they hold it back from wife or husband. But whomever they're holding it back from, the moment they embark upon that course, who does know about it? Jesus, God. So what does that mean they've already made up their mind about this person? That they don't care what God thinks. And they don't care what Jesus thinks. And when a person has gotten to the point that he doesn't care what God thinks and he doesn't care what Jesus thinks, then who does he care about what somebody thinks? Does he care about what his mother thinks? Does he care about? No. That's right. It's just what he thinks. So we need to know, Jesus, I know your works. Now, particularly here, he was telling Ephesus, as Tom pointed out, I know your works. And he wasn't saying here, and you don't have any. No, he had some commendable things to say about Ephesus. I know your works and your toil and your steadfastness. The steadfastness, the keeping on, the perseverance at doing whatever those works were. And that you cannot bear evil men. And that you did try them that call themselves apostles and they are not. And did find them false. So there were men in that day who were going about parading themselves as apostles. Anybody like that today? Anybody going around parading themselves as apostles today and claiming to have all kinds of powers and claim, well, they did back then. And that was not long. I mean, this was back then. This is 2,000 years later. So nothing's changed, has it, on that score. And I am glad, I appreciate the fact that you tried them, you found they are not, you found them false. So he really commends them for what they have done here. Now, one of the things that we have talked about, but we're not making a major issue of this, we're trying not to make a major issue of this, is that the two dates suggested for the writing of Revelation would be, one would be shortly before AD 70, and the other would be AD 96. Now, one of the things to think about is this church at Ephesus. We know that, let me give you just a little, remind you of a little New Testament chronology here. Remember that when Paul was at Ephesus, he was at Ephesus leading up to the time he wrote the book of 1 Corinthians, and that was about 57. So he was there like 54, 55, 56, 57, somewhere along there. Put that 3 years in there coming up on the end of 57. He then goes over to Corinth, writes the second letter, then makes his way on to Corinth. You remember that horseshoe I showed you? He went up around the horseshoe, comes to Macedonia, writes 2 Corinthians, and comes on down to Corinth. And from there, he writes Romans, and that would be dated about 58. So then, when he left Corinth, after the winter was over there, he left Corinth, sailing back to Jerusalem. But before he did that, he backtracked, walked back up through Macedonia, sailed over to Troas, met with the disciples there, and continued sailing, and he called the elders of the church at Ephesus to meet him at Miletus. Do you remember that story? He called the elders to meet him at Miletus. That would have been in 58. Now, would those elders could all have been dead in 8 years. 8 or 9 years. They could have all been dead. And that church, which at that point was still a fairly new, fresh church, see? I mean, there would have been saints there because of the work of Priscilla and Aquila before Paul got there. He left them to work there at the close of the second journey. But the main thrust and emphasis of the work in Corinth, I mean, in Ephesus would have been like 55, 56, and 57, along in there. And now we're looking at 8, 9 years later. And you have left your first love. Those elders that were there, they must all be gone or they've corrupted, whatever. To me, it would probably be more reasonable to assume that it is later than that. More likely the 96 date. Because that would have given time for a generation to pass and another generation to come along for a lot of things to happen. So that's just one of those things to think about. There's been a lot to happen to Ephesus in that few years. If it was written earlier. So whatever it is, they have begun to, their faithfulness has begun to erode. And unfortunately, it doesn't take a church very long to become unfaithful, does it? If the right things start happening, it can happen very fast. So I know that's true. I have this against thee, that you have left your first love. Remember therefore whence you are fallen, and repent, and do the first works, or else I come to thee and will remove thy candlestick out of its place if you don't repent. So at this point, though there was something wrong at Ephesus, was it still one of the lampstands in place around the Lord? Yes. But he has found something that he wants corrected. And if the thing is not corrected, then what's going to happen? Move the candlestick out of its place. So you have, what does he say? You have left your first love. You have left your first love. And yet look at the other things that they were doing. So does this mean that they have become atheists? It doesn't mean they've become atheists. It doesn't mean they've quit. What does it mean? Some of you, what does it mean that they have left their first love? What do you think that means? All right, Charles, what? In what sense, Charles? Okay. Now, is that true of doctrine? Or was it in some other area? Okay. Buford? They've fallen away from that first zeal. And like you say, you know, you first converted, man, you're so full of it, you want to tell everybody. And then it gets ho-hum if you're not careful. Marty? Yes. 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 So, yes, just like you said, Charles, they'd fallen away. But I believe what they fell away, you know, was not a embracing false doctrine. But it was like they were kind of going through the motions. Like, suppose that you come to church on Sunday morning because you have done that for 40 years. And you get here and You just, stuff is said, yeah, okay. We get up here, it's time to sing, and so we sing. And what did we sing? Well, I don't know. I didn't particularly notice. I was thinking about something else. Oh, and you have the Lord's Supper, and, you know, you're not putting yourself into it. Yes, they became stagnant. So the thing I want us to understand is that this is a warning that we and all churches need to take heed to. What happened to Ephesus can happen to us. You've heard of second generation Christianity. You've heard of that. Well, it doesn't have to happen. In other words, you've got one generation that's converted and is fervent and on fire. And then the children come along and they take it for granted. They didn't have to fight for it. They didn't have to sacrifice for it. And they just take it for granted. But that doesn't have to happen. Yes. Yeah, I like that. Tom? Yes. So they've done some things right. They were doing some good things, but what he's saying is you need your fervor back. You need your zeal back. You need your energy back. And you know, really, doesn't that sort of thing happen in most human relationships as well? And you have to periodically kind of take stock and renew, like in a marriage. It can certainly happen in a marriage. And sometimes in a marriage, you'll begin to kind of think about things, you know, being kind of ho-hum, and then something happens. And maybe your loved one is threatened or something, and you realize suddenly, you know, I can't take this for granted. And suddenly you say, I'm going to renew my attention because this is a person I genuinely do love and I can't do without. And you renew that fervor and that zeal for that one. And so that's what the Lord is here saying. But it's important. It is important. It's vital. Not just important, it's vital because remember whence you were fallen and repent and do the first works. And see, here's the thing now. None of us can sit here and say, You know, I'm kind of lacking zeal, and I don't have much energy for the Lord. So I guess I'm going to have to change that, or I'm going to go to hell. You're going to have some more work to do. Because when you do whatever you do, because I gotta, you're not getting there yet. I'm not getting there yet. This zeal, this love that he's talking about comes from inside. It doesn't come from external compulsion. Yes, the Lord is saying, if you don't have that in your heart, yes, he's telling us from outside. He out here is telling us that. But if we don't get it from the inside of our own hearts, then it's not going to happen. So it's important. It's important, but don't get to thinking that all it means is if I start going through more motions, you know, I'm already going through motions, so I'm going to start going through more motions. Do you see what I'm saying? It's not that. It's got to come from the inside. So he warns them of this. This is dangerous. But this you have, he says, that you hate the work of the Nicolaitans. Now, the only identity that I can find about the Nicolaitans here is actually in the book of Revelation, in the other column in my Bible, where it talks about in the letter to the church at Pergamum, and some have Pergamum, some have Pergamus, but it's the same place. As he talks there in verse 14, I have a few things against thee, because thou hast there some that hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit fornication. So hast thou also some that hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans in like manner. So that helps us to identify at least what the Nicolaitans were doctrinally. They were some who were practicing, or who were preaching the idea that you could practice immorality without compromising your Christianity. You could practice immorality without defiling your spirit necessarily. And the doctrine, if we were to just search around and say, now what doctrine does that sound like? The doctrine that sounds more like is Gnosticism. A doctrine that was in its infancy at this point, but it was coming along. And actually by the end of the first century, it was coming along pretty strong. And there are several practitioners of Gnosticism that we already know the names of. Okay. Bell ring? Yeah? There it is. Okay. Yes.